good friends of the show at Cyana. I think we've got to be careful not to go off the rails, because I'm not a fan of what we've seen here. So there have been some board changes. The managing director has left. That's Brett Lynch.
Effective immediately.
We spoke about him.
Personal reasons, yeah.
For personal reasons, which we, you know, you have to respect.
Down, they are down 25% today, JD.
It's nice 30, mate.
I think that reaction that the market is showing toward this stock is the exact reaction that we have. I don't like this. A company's managing director resigning during ramp up is enough of a red flag. Doing it a few weeks after being paid $1.9 million retroactively is not a good look. And
it's horrible.
I mean, I'm not too sure there's much more I can say on that one.
Right, boys, Fortescue.
The good news rolls on.
Another, and we're talking like the 10th, are we? Leadership change.
Yep, 10th in the past roughly 3 years.
The CEO, Fiona Hick, has mutually agreed to leave after 6 months.
Fonticlear. They had a summary or a headline that summarised this one best. Fortescue's revolving door is a joke.
Righto, buddy miners. Welcome to Hay Street. Boys, what a bloody achievement. 4 months in and we have got bloody high rolling office space.
What a momentous occasion, Matty. I think this is a moment worth celebrating. Unfortunately, we don't have a beer in here to celebrate yet, but that's on the to-do list.
Can I get
any encouragement on that part?
What about a kegerator with Swan Draft on tap, or whichever beer brewer bloody beverage person sponsors us?
Swanny D should be so lucky, mate.
Oh, how bloody good is it? Well, boys, and you know the best thing, Trav, and we're going to get into it today, being in West Perth gave us the opportunity to just walk down to the road to the CWA play. There was no scones, jam and cream there for the 5-inch vote.
Yeah, we went to the 5-inch general meeting, which was called upon by disgruntled shareholders in a bid to oust the board there. It was actually a very educational experience. I'm sure you and I will go into that in a moment.
Your first shareholder meeting you've been to, right?
Yes. Been to like a AGM before, but not like an actual 249D. This ain't your usual bloody cup of tea.
Exactly. A pretty exciting one. What else have we got today?
Right, boys. A few cap raises, eh?
Yeah.
A couple of cap raises going on. A couple of significant leadership changes in the industry.
Yeah, there's a lot to dig in on that front. Obviously, we're talking about Fortescue. There's the big one, and also some movement at Sayona, which is definitely going to get a mention.
Friends of the show.
Yeah. Bowen Coking Coal had an interesting update. Bowen?
Bowen Mangoes. You heard of the Bowen Mango, JD? You need to get over Eastmore, mate.
I'm learning from you every day, mate.
Everything about Queensland.
Yeah. Remelius also had some news out. WA1 and, like you said, a couple capital raises, which we'll touch on in a broader way.
Sensational. Righto, first bloody episode of the West Perth era for Money of Mine is brought to you by our great friends at Top Drill.
Mate, I can see a small part of JD die inside every time you mention West Perth. Let's just call it the Money of Mine podcast studio.
A bit of him dies every time we mention a sponsor.
This building's got a name, doesn't it? Like, let's just call
1202 Hay Street.
We'll call it.
No, it's got a proper name.
Yeah, I reckon JD would want to not associate himself with West Perth.
you really created such a character around me. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're the youngest, but you're the oldest man.
How I feel about it.
You're like the grandpa in Money of Mine. Harry to be bloody frothing that we're mentioning the street address, so we're not giving away free rental sponsorship. Thanks to Top Drill for supporting Money of Mine. As always, Toppy and Ange looking straight at you. Cheers. Drilling into the future. Boys, let's get into it.
Yeah, I'm keen to hear from you guys. First of all, let's get into 5-inch at the top of the show. So you guys wandered down. They had the meeting at 10 a.m. this morning. Now, for those that didn't catch our 5-inch bonanza show, we went into the full history of what has gone on there from when the company was first called Marley Lithium. Then they had the spin out, the Goulamina asset came out with Leo Lithium, and we really fleshed that in. It was a great show. Paddy, the intern, went into some real depth there. It was fascinating to hear what's gone on. So the company's obviously been in suspension for getting on 14 months now. What was the mood like in the room there?
Well, it was interesting walking in, because we're like, are we actually going to get allowed in? Because the person at the front with the computer, and we're not shareholders. They're like, I'll just take a visitor's pass.
Yeah.
And all full credit to Trav. He's bloody he puts the balls on the line these days and he's straight in there. So I probably would have been like, this looks too hard. But we walked in as it was underway. I think they were on the second resolution.
Yeah, they were. We probably missed the juiciest bit, but I felt like it was still
it
very
was still bloody
drama
juicy,
heavy.
Yeah.
So you would have felt the tension in the room, right?
Oh, mate, it was hot. And like that's not just because I think they didn't have aircon on. That was because you could really absolutely feel the emotion. It was intense. You could... You know, I don't want to make assumptions, but you could feel the disdain that the shareholders had for the board, and equally, I felt you could also feel the disdain some of the board had for the shareholders in front of them. It was a real tense moment.
And a lot of that disdain was coming from one shareholder specifically. he was pretty active.
But I dare say he's representative of the wider picture there. There's obviously a lot of shareholders that couldn't make it today. Yeah. And that one shareholder is obviously voicing his concern, the one you told me about.
Mm.
But I think it'd be right to say that's fairly representative of how a lot of the sort of, you know, a lot of the tension that exists between the two parties, right?
And I guess for people that don't know what was going on, this was the 249D vote to remove the company's non-exec directors, Brett Fraser, Bradley Gordon and Mark Hepburn, and to appoint two new directors, Gary Lower and Gareth John Edwards, and there was another, it said, subsequently one of the convening shareholders nominated Mr. Zoran Mehmed, who is a significant shareholder himself. So, look, the result was the incumbent board won, essentially, 62 to 38. So the 249D failed, which was, as was mentioned in the episode, was brought about by the Hot Copper folk on a GoFundMe page, a bit unorthodox of how you'd see a 249D established.
And they also had the opportunity to talk, right?
That they did, and geez, didn't that make it bloody interesting? Oh, that was great. Trav, there was
Q&A,
some...
Q&A was wicked.
Oh, and there was some, you'd say there was a bit of abuse getting hurled at the incumbent board. Trav, highlights for you, mate.
I had
a couple of things stood out to you.
Yeah, a few takeaways. And I think in our previous coverage, we highlighted the mammoth task that the requisitioning shareholders were up against when you try and have a successful 249D. These things are really, really hard to accomplish and very rarely have the result the requisitioning shareholders want. And that's largely because you need to convince the proxy advisors to vote your way. The default position of a proxy advisor is to defend the incumbent board unless you have a very, very sophisticated campaign that articulates why this new board is going to be far better, far more experienced and have a better strategy. And in this case, all of the three proposed new directors talked very briefly. The very first statement all three of them made was, I don't have any ASX experience, but... And what came after the but was very, very valid, but I think the fact that they all started with, I don't have ASX experience, kind of hones in on what would have been one of the highlighted points made by the proxy whisperers to convince the proxy advisors not to support the requisitioning shareholders in this vote. One quote that really sort of stood out to me, Maddie, was from that third board member, Zoran Mehmed, who you mentioned.
The third proposed board member by the requisitioning.
So he said, and I'm paraphrasing here because I can't remember his exact words, but he said something along the lines of, I purely want what's best for shareholders. I want to make sure the cash that is left in this vehicle is distributed and the LLL shares that Firefinch has are also distributed as soon as possible. He also said that if you add up all of the shares owned by the incumbent board, that Zoran's personal shareholding is many multiples of that. You know, he disclosed that he owned about 9 million shares himself. And it was a kind of astonishing figure, right?
Yeah, 1.1 billion shares on issue. So I think if he has 10 million, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
No, 1% of the company, not 10.
Correct, yeah. 1%, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sort of, I think for me, really honed in on that point of alignment. And, you know, this is something we talk about a lot and we'll continue to talk about a lot, is the fact that... The vibe in that room was that shareholders were disgruntled because they felt like the incumbent board might be more persuaded by maybe a salary or whatnot. They quoted the number $2 million is coming out of this company every single quarter. And if you think about the dynamics of a board member, what sometimes might be important, I'm speaking generally here, not specific to Firefinch, sometimes might be more important is the NPV of your wage as a director as opposed to the actual capital gain of your shares because you don't own enough shares. And so I think what you saw here was the shareholders were trying to put forward three people who own material amounts of Fire Finch shares, and that was a way to sort of maximise alignment with the other shareholders.
And it was the question was raised from the audience or the requisitioning shareholders to one of the Mr. Lower, I think, asking, oh, look, do you intend to asking a question about the Leo Lithium shares out of escrow. Do you intend to distribute them as soon as they come out of escrow? He's like, no, I can't comment on that. Sorry. But Mr. Mehmed, Zora Mehmed, he went straight into it and then even highlighted the amount of 249Ds that the incumbent board had been to, like pointed them one by one. How many? You've been through four. You've been through. This is your second, isn't it? This is your first. It was, it started to get a bit heated at the end there. It was very interesting to watch.
And from Zoran, it was an admission of, I wish I did my homework on these board members before I bought all of these shares.
I think he actually said that.
Yeah, which, you know, he was speaking to the fact that the board members, he felt like, had a history of creating an environment where shareholders become disgruntled. This is the ultimate feat of that at Section 249D.
So when you talk about the proxy whisperers, Trav, because you think if this 249D can't get up after everything that Fire Finch has gone through, he's like, right, what 249D could get up? But you're saying a big function of that is the fact that the requisitioning shareholders, which were from Hot Copper and everyone, which you need 5% or more, because they didn't have a proxy whisperer on their side, they didn't have that extra force to get it over the line. Do you think that was a big driving factor?
I think so. Yeah. I do. Yeah.
Bloody good in that. Jeez, you should start a bloody mining podcast, Trav. You're a bloody great analysis.
It was an awesome educational experience to go to that. I mean, hopefully in the future we can see shareholders kind of align themselves in a way that they have, like sort of, you know, like they have coordinated themselves sort of, you know, independently of a real sophisticated party. Hopefully they can do that in the future in a way that actually is effective. And that'll probably require hiring proxy whisperers.
Yeah. I was surprised they let me in board shorts and thongs. That was the best thing. I'm running it. I'm not conforming to West Perth suit and tie. Fuck it. No, I'm not.
I love it, mate.
And that'd make you happy, wouldn't it, JD?
Mate, I'm in the shorts here as well, mate. No beautiful, shoes. Beautiful, we're on the same page.
We've just dropped the value of 1202 Hay Street today only. Right, JD. Ramelius Musgrave.
Nothing too notable here. Ramelius has come out and said
there's a bee's dick in it left. They're nearly to 50%.
Okay.
They're bloody close.
Thanks for translating. So Ramelius have come forward and said that their bid to take out Musgrave is now unconditional. So they said that their share ownership is at 47.3%. Obviously, we've spoken about this in the past. The Musgrave directors have already unanimously recommended the takeover. So it's sort of interesting to think what sort of changes now. Why do you still have roughly 53% of the shareholders not voting it through? And I think there's a range of reasons. We've spoken about this at length on the Mincor takeover. So one potential reason could be tax benefits. There's, you know, shareholders that might have bought 11 and a bit months ago trying to hang on. You got the remaining few that might be holding on for a better offer, which seems pretty unlikely, but highly unlikely at this point in time. I mean, others just don't know about it, haven't, you know, forgot they hold the shares. There's a small percent like that. And then you've also got ETFs. There might be ETFs in particular, if there are passive funds in and around that, you know, like we touched on again with the Mincor, haven't got round to accepting. So that's probably what's really holding it up. And something that Ramelius have chucked in to try and get this one over the line is their dividend. So they declared a 2-cent dividend per share. And the record date, I believe, is the 15th of September. So if the shareholders of Musgrave get around to accepting prior to this time, they're entitled to receive that dividend.
Oh, it's a juicy incentive, isn't it?
I mean, do you boys want to do a bit of finance 101 education for the money miners out there that might be from a mining background like me without notice?
No guarantee that we'll have
the answer. I reckon you've got it in you. Explain why and the different forms of takeovers, mergers and purchases and everything. Like, you know, how Wyloo had to get 90% to get to compulsory acquisition to take out Mincor, whereas Ramelius have to get 50%, need to take 75%. Explain why this one's 50 and everything.
There's a few different reasons. To be clear on this one, it doesn't become compulsory at 50%. Mm. Like they're at 47%, you just get to a majority and you're controlling the company. There's a range of different reasons. One might be to do with the company's, you know, bylaws itself, but in general, the rule for compulsory is 90% for ASX listed companies.
And which is 75 is sometimes a number used, is it?
I don't think that's for Australian companies.
Maybe that's a vote. I think that's a voting thing.
Yeah, there's different, you know, votes, and like you would have seen resolutions, they might need 50% at
that depends EGM on the constitution.
Or an AGM. That depends on the company's constitution. Yeah. But compulsory takeovers, like, but by far and away need 90%.
I think there's an episode, Maddie, you know, I should be more of an expert on this, but I think there's a better episode to do with a corporate lawyer. Who's just an M&A lawyer.
Make someone else sort it out. I like it. I like it. Good work, Trav. You're starting to learn off me. Righto, next up, JD. God, the Westerunter.
The Westerunter.
What a bloody region.
The fabled Westerunter.
What an exciting region. Wouldn't go there for a bloody holiday. I can give you a tip. Geez, I know. Before you get into it, now that we're a bit more confined, I feel bad if I vape. Because I was offing me lonesome in the old setup, and I could just let yous go to town. But now I feel like I'd be interrupting. So.
I feel like the quality of our audio will improve, because every time you would vape on cue, I reckon 30 seconds later you would cough.
Right,
hey, we're doing you a favour as well, mate. So first up with WA1, we've got a disclose. I own a couple shares in this one.
So do I. Yeah.
So does Trav. So they had assays come out from three holes that they'd drilled to the eastern extent of their Lunny or Loony, were you guys saying?
Loony. Oh, no, I'm Loony.
It's Loony. It's definitely Loony.
Definitely Loony. Loony.
Carbonatite complex. So a couple of the results. One of the holes that was notable from 40 metres had 17 metres at 2% niobium pentoxide. And that was, like I said, 400 metres east of the previous holes. And the other couple holes came in at 0.5%. I think one was at 29 metres, the other was for 54 metres, the intervals. So the stock hasn't really moved too much on the news, and I think that really speaks to what's coming next. Everyone in the market wants to see MET results for this company. Yeah. That's what the fix is on. That's what people want to see. The market cap on a fully diluted basis at what they're trading at now, $5.15, is around about $300 million, which, you know, that's, I guess, what the market feels is kind of right for this, given that everything sort of hinges on MET.
Mm. Yeah. So is that, do you reckon that metallurgy will come out, that'll probably come out by itself, or will it be a part of, it won't be accompanied within some sort of scoping study? You think the metallurgy will be sort of
coming out on its results based on some drill results. The market's not going to wait for a scoping study for those sorts of results.
I think it'd still be a bloody far long way away to fully understand what this deposit is to get a scoping study.
Yeah, I mean, they pushed back the maiden resource from the quarter four of this calendar year until the first half of next year. So as you can imagine, a scoping study would come after that. So the market is going to want to see much prior to that what the MET looks like.
Jaddy, was my impression of this announcement correct in sort of saying that it's potentially open further to the eastern edge now than it, you know, is kind of modelled in their diagrams?
I mean, I think you could see that these results are at the eastern end of the grid that they'd drilled out. So it's, you know, at the eastern extent what they'd planned to do. Obviously, two of the holes hadn't come in as high a grade as what the other ones had. But, you know, this one of them coming in with
the intersection.
Yeah, at 2% is a pretty encouraging result. So I'm sure in a later drill campaign, they will be planning a few holes further out that way, as well as what they'd previously touched on, which is more infill drilling, going from a 200 by 200 to a 100 by 100 to get a better understanding of what they've got.
So it looks like it's going to be the easiest fucking thing to mine in the world. Like everything is just like 17 metres at 40 metres depth. Like it's just going to be, you'd anticipate just free dig, just rip it up.
Yeah,
like
if the MET works.
If the MET works. But as old Manny Dat said, if grade's on your side, you've got a lot of flexibility with metallurgy as well.
So it does help, yeah.
Yeah, exciting stuff.
Manny does have, you know, we have to say he's got a bit of like tinted glasses. He obviously wants this to go well. He's a shareholder, so we have to sort of disclose that too.
Yeah, no, we do, yeah. God, true friend of the show. Now, before we get into the next one, you'll notice.
Before we get into the real friends of the show, mate.
Yeah, the real friends of the show. Trav's, you'll see Trav's Bloomberg laptop, Bloomberg keyboard here.
Trav's.
We're looking, is it yours?
Trav, have you ever used Bloomberg?
It was left here, but I felt like it's a a nice little object for us to include. We had it on the bookshelf, but Maddie's brought it right out in front of the potty here.
It's a bit of a call for props.
Yeah.
Anyone in West Perth, if you've got some toy jumbos or bloody shit that we can use, don't fucking give me something with your company logo just to try and flash it, because
while you post that one up there with a big Bloomberg.
True.
Bloomberg is one of the best businesses ever to be created.
That's
so
amazing.
Was there an acquired episode on it, JD?
No, there hasn't been.
Should be.
There should be. It is a phenomenal business.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, call for props. If you want your company logo, you're probably going to have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, like, just send us some props. We want to deck out
mining
the table
and finance
us.
Stuff, yeah.
Mining and finance props, we will take them at 1202 Hay Street.
Absolutely.
Boys, capital raisings. And as a great term from the people that got me here from Precision Funds Management, who's shaking the tin?
Who's shaking the tin? I like that.
Shaking the tin, boys.
So we've got a couple to talk about today. First up is Antipa. So they're up in the Pilbara looking for gold. They've got a couple interesting JVs, and one of the partnerships that they have is with Newcrest, who have decided to maintain their 9.9% ownership in the company. So they've gone in. So they took in $5 million. They issued at 1.3 cents, and there are oppies involved, as we'll touch on with our next capital raising as well. So
common theme, isn't it? The old one for
that's
two.
That's it. So 1 for 2 options exercisable at 2 cents. The stock has come off. They're now trading again right back down to the issue price. So that's 1.3 cents. And to your point, Matty, that it just, you know, it's a common theme because you need to incentivize these shareholders in the market we're in to come on board. And the way you do that, offer them an option.
I think is it also incentivizing the ECMs to actually do the deals, because they're going to be partaking in these options to get it over the line a bit?
Well, the options go to maybe a broker fee includes options too. I haven't read those terms, but yeah, the options is like the broker is only going to do the deal or get it done if the demand is actually there. And the way you can guarantee the demand to be there is you have to offer a little bit extra, which is these oppies. But a 1 for 2 option, yeah, it's and it's not too far out, you know, much of a premium above what the actual.
Well, they were there the other week.
Yeah, so it's an attractive option. So you can see how that can
incentivize
people.
I'm talking about the next one. Sorry, I'm not sure where Antipa was.
But it's a hard pill to swallow for existing shareholders when you kind of, you know, are writing new paper that fast, and it doesn't. It's not like it's bringing in a huge amount of new money.
And yeah, does it put in a bit of a seal, like a not a ceiling, but like, you know, when they become in the money, then you get a bit more selling pressure of people taking the dosh.
Maybe. Maybe. That's a factor too.
Which is more dilutive.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. I mean, this was $5 million raise on a company that's capped at about $50 million now. So it's, you know, with the options as well, it's pretty dilutive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on that theme, Black Cat was the other one. They're raising at 22 and a half cents. We spoke about them a bit in the past. Their 22 and a half cent price that they're raising at is a 52-week low. They were at a 52-week low before they went into the
I've got the I've got the chart up here. So they were
the candlestick.
You love a good candlestick, don't you? I love a candlestick. You've got to see the gaps, JD. The gapping can tell you so much.
trading experts.
But 52-week lows raising. And same thing as you said, so raising at 22 and a half cents plus the attaching 1 for 2 option at 33.75 cents.
And they were at 26 cents before going into the, or 26 and a half before going into the trading halt pending capital raise. So
what do you guys make of the use of funds? I mean, they were pretty specific in some of the goals of the use of funds. I haven't seen, kind of very like specific kind of use of funds like I've seen here in a long time.
So for people tuning in,
they're trying to justify why it's not going towards the restart.
Right.
It's going towards resource definition and further studies. And it did have targeting 10% reduction in the pre-production capital from 42.9 to 38 million based on these studies to increase met recovery and mill utilisation. But the main, as it says here, it's drilling to add resource to the main zone extension, which is the deepest part down the bottom.
So for people listening on the audio, they're raising 7 million. 4.7 was going to ongoing exploration and evaluation at Paulsens. And then they've got another 0.7 million going to study optimization and debt negotiation. And then the remainder 1.6 million for general working capital and corporate costs.
So long and the short, they're going to need at least minimum 38 million coming up soon by via debt or equity or a mixture of both. So look, it did say they've received indicative term sheets from a number of debt providers currently in the process of finalising. So I think based on the hot copper thread, I think everyone's just wanting to know, will it start? Will it restart? What's it going to cost? Is it going to restart?
And imagine if you spoke to management, their response would be, we want to do the restart sooner, but we want to be able to raise money at a higher share price so that it's less dilutive when we do have to raise that much money.
Exactly.
By a combination of debt and equity.
Guys, I'm itching to talk about the next one.
Sayona. JD, talk about a soft spot in your heart.
Soft spot. Good friends of the show at Sayona. I think we've got to be careful not to go off the rails because I'm not a fan of what we've seen here. So for those that haven't caught it, there have been some board changes. The managing director has left. That's Brett Lynch.
Effective immediately.
We personal spoke reasons. About him.
Personal reasons, yeah.
For personal reasons, which we, you know, you have to respect. But we've spoken about him not too long ago in the past, and that was with regard to 10 million shares that he'd been awarded retroactively. So that was for work done prior. And at the time, they were, you know, trading at 19 or so cents. That's $1.9 million worth of stock that he has been issued.
That resolution, by the way, passed with a glowing 53% approval from shareholders.
Yeah, 54.29.
Hey, you got it there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
now that's another bee's dick. Yeah. Is that a term? You ever heard that before, JD?
I think I might have. I have now in any case. So Brett Lynch still has roughly 175 million shares, and as he's no longer a director, he'll be free to sell them without notifying them. The company has over 10 billion shares on issue, so nothing will be triggered on that sort of part.
Down, that's a lot of shares down, on issue, mate.
They are down 25% today, JD.
It's 30, mate.
I mean, that.
Oh, is it up to 30 now? God,
I saw it at 30 today.
Oh, wow. That's why the candlesticks are good, JD.
I think that reaction that the market is showing toward this stock is the exact reaction that we have. I don't like this. A company's managing director resigning during ramp up is enough of a red flag. Doing it a few weeks after being paid $1.9 million retroactively is not a good look. And
it's horrible.
I mean, I'm not too sure there's much more I can say on that one without.
Yeah. I think it's just in terms of looking at investor confidence in ramp up and all this happening. Yes, it's an investment red flag.
You'd have to absolutely love the project if you're going to get comfortable investing in this. You just have to think it's a knockout project to get comfortable with some of the other stuff that we've seen.
The huge challenge is it comes at a time when shareholders still have questions that, you know, there's not enough color provided to them yet about. The big things that shareholders want to know is what price are they getting for their product? How is ramp up going? Like, how long is it going to take to get to nameplate? I think there's a bit more color to come out about this operation. Keep in mind, North American Lithium has a history of being a tricky asset. So there's just going to be big question marks that are going to flow through. And now they're going to flow
through.
By
tricky, you mean it put a company into bankruptcy?
There were two distress situations from it from prior owners. Heck, you know, it's like lithium market's healthy. So, you know, it might make money at the, at the right price and all that sort of stuff. But I just think there's sometimes real issues that come through ramp up, and we're just going to have to, you know, unfortunately, like go through that experience. Shareholders are going to have to go through that experience with a new MD, and it's going to feel like that new MD might not necessarily be accountable. It's just a different,
There was a quote that stood out to me near the end of the announcement today. The board will take this opportunity to undertake a thorough review of operations and the strategic direction of the company to further enhance shareholder and stakeholder value.
What do you reckon? We hit up JB Search for a bit of recruitment cost. Geez, if we can get them the bloody, then they'll keep sponsoring. Right.
There we go.
You had enough there?
I think we can leave that one there.
You said what you needed to say, JD?
Yeah.
Good on you. Good on you, mate.
How about we get into Bow and Coke and Coal?
I had to delete a couple of aggressive lines that you put in. Bow and Coke and Coal, or as most other people pronounce it, Bowen, Coke and Coal. But you can, JD, you be you. You be you.
Sore like an eagle. Bowen.
It's Bowen.
Bowen.
Yeah.
Bowen, Coke and Coal.
Yeah.
Oh, is that not what I'd said?
No.
You said Bowen.
Oh, I was trying to emphasise the Aussie accent for you.
Bowen.
Okay. But Bowen's easier for me, so that's all good.
Strong.
Okay. So they've got a strategic review and an update, and strategic review.
Strategic review. That's as nearly much as a red flag as what we'd previously discussed.
You're too right, Matty. They don't bode well, and the company's stock is down 30% today on the news. So they've got a couple high cost coke and coal operations up in sunny and balmy Queensland. Up near Mackay. They've got quite a few different operations. They've picked some up over the past year. And there's a few quotes from the announcement today that kind of stand out and speak for themselves. Bowen has taken steps to adjust the mine plan to maximise cash flow. After completing an internal strategic review, Bowen will concentrate on mining operations of its higher margin deposits. The project estimate has increased from 14 million to 20 million. So there's a lot of sort of chatter of that sort of nature.
They're high grading.
Yeah, that's just scratching the surface. Things aren't going too well. You know, you're in a, like we said, a high cost mining area. These all the operations are pretty high cost that they have. Coking coal prices and thermal coal prices have come off quite a bit. Granted, they were at phenomenally high highs last year, but it's not boding well. They've also said they've got one of their assets, the Isaac River asset. They've got a sale process on it. And this one abuts the Daunia project, which has been in the news for a long time now, that BHP and Mitsubishi are trying to sell along with Blackwater.
I think so. And just that comment you made there, JD, that they said Bowen has taken steps to adjust the mine plan to maximise cash flow. So that the implications of that, like you see it all the time in underground mines and open pits are the same, it just pretty much means you're taking all the ore that is available now, and you would, for an open pit case, you'd probably be stopping the pre-stripping capex. For an underground case, you'd stop developing your decline. So, look, short term you can survive, but eventually it gets to the stage. Yeah. It just bites you in the ass and you got nothing to fucking mine.
Key word there, Matty, is short term, and I think this company has more short term focus because there's balance sheet stress.
Yeah. So like, but it gets to the stage, if you do get the balance sheet underway, it then bites you in the ass because you've got to put so much more capital in, and it's not the money that goes into it, it's time. Like, you can't usually develop it quicker than you're going to develop it anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's where it bites companies in the ass later on when they get in this position.
Agreed. On the balance sheet, Trav, they've got $46 million in cash as of the last quarterly. They've raised quite a few times over the past year. They have $133 million in fully drawn debt, as well as a $40 million con note that's outstanding.
I looked at that quarterly, JD, and I think their cash flow from operations in the last quarter was negative $19 million, and you can't continue that for too long without a funding problem sort of opening up. And correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the financiers of their debt facility is Taurus.
Yep, that's
Taurus
right.
Won't be friendly for too long.
Absolutely. So to our point on Sayona before, this company...
Taurus have got some unfriendly debt situations, don't they?
Yeah, it comes with the territory when you go in, like they go high up on the risk curve.
Yeah, right.
You know, that comes with the territory that you're going to have, you know, some tricky situations when you do that.
And just to what we touched on with Sayona as well, these guys have had a number of directors that have resigned in the last quarter alone. So
yeah, I did see that back in July.
Good look.
And I saw also today Data Room in the Australian is reporting that Terracom has been looking at acquiring Bowen. I mean, given some of the stuff we read out of Data Room, I don't know if you can hold any weight to anything that comes out of that column.
But Jesus Christ, you can hold some weight. The stuff that comes out of Money of Mine. Tell
exactly
you what, right. Money of Mine is.
Exactly.
You can trust us. Mm. Right, boys, Fortescue.
The good news rolls on.
Another, and we're talking like the 10th, are we, leadership change?
Yep, 10th in the past roughly 3 years.
Wow. Wow.
It's not just TO, but it's executive level.
Well, and this isn't just one of your directors, one of your base directors. This is the CEO. Fiona Hick has, I'll read the words out later, but mutually agreed to leave after 6 months, and the current COO of Iron Ore, Dino Otranto, has been promoted to CEO. How would you pronounce that, JD? Otranto?
Otranto, yeah.
Otranto. That okay. Yeah, that's better. I like that. Yeah. Dino, let us know, mate.
Yeah, so Fiona Hick leaving after 6 months. I mean, that, you know, this is a $60 billion company. CEOs don't leave after 6 months at, you know, companies like that, where I think she had the potential with all her incentives to earn up to $7.5 million in a year. They don't leave unless they're, you know, seriously unhappy or... I mean,
it'd be tough to get a better offer.
Yeah, it's
there's potential, but
it raises a bunch of questions.
Like, yeah, and it's not the first. I mean, the Chanticleer or Chanticleer, maybe?
Chanticleer. Yeah.
They had a summary or a headline that summarized this one best. Fortescue's revolving door is a joke.
Yeah, well, that's
punchy words.
That's very punchy, much more to be said.
And I mean, the stock is off 5 or 6%. Granted, it's not the only piece of bad news that had come out as well. There was an impairment of US $1 billion. So that's to do with Iron Bridge, right? Which came in over budget and, you know, over time as well.
Yeah, I mean, they on Iron Bridge, that impairment, they referenced delays, cost inflation, and an uplift in discount rate, you know, as being the cause of that impairment. It does, again, pose a question about what's the NPV of this project, given it's only recently been ramping up and that stuff will flow through over time. And plus there was $800 million OPEX guidance in relation to FFI. And, you know, that's for an entity which doesn't yet have revenue. So, again, it's just – I think that what you see in that share price coming off is just question marks sort of being raised, and maybe it's just going to take a while for those questions to be answered. But, yeah, I mean, that revolving door is a pretty remarkable thing. I think you had a stat on that one, JD.
Yeah, 10 execs have left in the past, you know, roughly 3 or so years. That's across, you know, the entirety of FMG. But it just doesn't bode well. You really wonder what goes on at an executive level there. Why the, you know, we really look for companies that have sustainability and, you know, durability within their management and executive team, where that intellectual property and the knowledge that they gain is kept within the organization so they continue to perform well. And the share price has performed well. You know, operations by and large have done well over the past few years, granted Ironbridge, which we just discussed, but it's just something that I think, you know, the market might be getting a bit fed up with at the moment.
And it was interesting looking at the annual report where it said the senior leadership changes, went through everything, and then the last paragraph, very brief, Fiona Hick was appointed CEO of Fortescue Metals February 2023. In August 2023, Fiona departed as CEO. And that's it. Like, that's like very two lines to say that your CEO is leaving after 6 months, right at the end of the paragraph. So, yes, very interesting. And I don't know if this is backhanded. Executive Chairman and Founder Dr. Andrew Forrest recognised Fiona's contribution to Fortescue. We thank Fiona for her valuable efforts since joining Fortescue just under 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So really, really highlighted that she was only there for 6 months.
That's it. Not too much else to be said on that one.
No, right. Gold Road. Half-yearly numbers are out.
Yeah, we'll flash them on screen. They look pretty good. Revenue, $229 million. They sold about 80,000 ounces, so this was roughly in line with the previous 6 months. Operating cash flow of $110 million with free cash flow of $75 million. So they got cash and equivalents of $153 million. They've also got that stake in De Grey, which is valued at a bit over $400 million. That's 19.99% stake in De Grey that they have. They're paying a dividend of 1.2 cents a share. So they did reiterate their guidance, although that had previously been pulled back a bit. So they're guiding to between 160 and 175,000 ounces at midpoint, all in sustaining cost of 1600 Aussie. So, I mean, the real question I have for you guys is, where do they go from here? They've got this non-operating Gruyere joint venture. They've got the big stake in De Grey. We've heard some sort of rumours about, you know, action at a corporate level. But where do they sort of go? I mean, like you said it earlier, Trav, they're like an average-looking royalty company.
They're the worst royalty company. You've got to pay costs.
You have costs.
Non-operating joint venture joint venture interest.
Exactly. That's for people wondering why you'd make the royalty analogy is because they're non-operating. You know, Goldfields operates the mine and they just have to, you know,
they've got a fair few more employees than a royalty company too.
Yeah,
mate.
that revenue per employee count's not quite as good as some other companies we've mentioned recently.
Exploration team, which is not done a lot.
But it is interesting to see where it kind of goes from here. Whether they, you know, bandy together with someone, whether they try and take out De Grey. I mean, that would be a real change in dynamic for the company because it would mean if they were to take a big swing, they would become an operator and all the challenges that. And on top of that, De Grey have. You know, they haven't even developed the asset yet.
I'm sure that if, like, whatever desires they have with De Grey, I'm almost certain their long-term plan would be, let's assume that they actually was successful in being able to acquire De Grey or merge with De Grey, right? What Gold Road would do if their management retained management of the pro forma is they would joint venture it out again. They do the 50% model and have a proven operator actually develop that asset because you need serious experience.
Yeah, and that's the key difference. You'd still need to develop that asset.
Yeah. I think in the hypothesized outcome that I did hear from someone a while ago, and it still makes the most sense, I thought, is that I haven't even been vaping. I'm still coughing. See, it's not the vape. It's the a habit. Gold. You know, wouldn't Goldfields just take out Gold Road and take out De Grey? Goldfields are going to, we're looking for ounces. They failed the Yamana deal. Wouldn't it make sense for someone like Goldfields just to swoop them up and then take the interest in all of it? But who knows?
Yeah.
I think that's a possible outcome anyway.
Yeah. And I think historically Gold Road were public about their interest in the Tropicana, the 30% non-controlling interest there when that became for sale from IGO. Ultimately, Regis were successful in the bid for that. But, you know, like it was, again, another one of those non-controlling joint venture interests in a really good asset, like similar to what they've got in Gruyere. So do they still have latent interest in that asset via a potential tie-up with Regis? I think, you know, that's another question as well. And then maybe some of their cash flow can fund McPhillamy's as well. You know, what does that mean for the pro forma? I think there's a bit to play out in that gold consolidation space, and none better than the episode with Ali to listen to have a taste of what
that flew on YouTube. Bloody Ali G just absolutely fucking kicked it out of the park.
Yeah, yeah, mate.
That was a ripper episode.
Hit it out of the park, sorry. But do you think from Goldfields' point of view, like, God, now it'd be the way the market is, God, if you're going to take them over, now would be a bloody good time, wouldn't it?
No, I don't. Who knows? Unless it goes, I mean, you know, we talk more about a tough market, but I think that's much more at the developer and explorer end of town. I don't think gold producers are being like horrendously marked down by any stretch.
The ones in Africa are, but yeah.
It's not like it's screaming cheap or anything at the moment.
Yes. Righto, boys.
Perfect.
What do you reckon?
Yeah.
Episode one in the bloody, shout out to the barn me rolls down the road. How fucking good are they?
Crispy, I think I want a second one, mate, for the day.
Yeah, no, you've got to get in before like around 11 to make sure the roast pork's available.
Yeah.
So, and look, money mine is, this is our first one that we've set up here. I'm happy to take feedback about setup improvements or stuff you'd like to see. Or look, we've me and JD pumped some bloody shit on the wall the other day. Look at that fucking wooden whatever they are, panels.
Wicked job. It's cladding. It's
cladding. We've chucked the cladding on the wall. We've got to fill in behind in the corners here. We've got to chuck some trees. But it's coming together. If there's any interior decorators that want to come to 1202 and lend some expertise,
pro bono,
or just bring a heap of shit with you, feel free. We'll let you in.
Yeah,
love it. In the back door.
It'll get better over time, I'm sure.
That's it.
So
especially with our partners continuing to fund us.
Oh, the
a segue.
Does that just make you bloody cringe, Jamie? Look at what I've made Trav into a money-making machine.
I say it as it. I got him like, I'm actually rushing you, Maddie. I'm like, hurry the fuck up.
Righto, Top Drill, K Drill,
Anytime
Exploration, Terra Capital, and JP Search, our great true friends of the show. Thank you for
appreciate
all your
the support, guys.
Hooteroo, money miners.
Hooteroo.
Straight from Hay Street.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.